The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, and thank you so very, very much on what is an exciting day for those of us affiliated with the Free Library in the city of Philadelphia, and in my case, Independence Blue Cross. My name is Chris Cashman. I'm Senior Vice President for Corporate and Public Affairs at Independence Blue Cross, and I have the distinct privilege of being with all of you tonight to help celebrate the closing ceremonies of what I think has been one of the absolutely finest One Book, One Philadelphia programs that we've experienced in all 5 years. You can clap for that. I didn't intend that you clap, but you should have clapped. Should have said here, pause for clap. But it didn't. You know, if I might, just for a second, one thing we try not to do when we get involved with events like this is try and do a commercial. But this program is so very important, we believe, at Independence Blue Cross because it's so much different than many things that we get involved with during the course of the year. We're involved with this initiative because we think it really does do the best of what we as a civilization do. It brings us all together around one book, in this case, three books, but one very special book. Gives us all a chance to read, to understand, to think a little bit about other cultures, other situations, things that we might not normally think about, and things that we might not normally talk about. And that's been the history of One Book, One Philadelphia. 5 years, five tremendous books, great discussion in our community, great discussion in our families, great discussion in our homes. And we think that's important, and we think that other companies, and there have been many who've helped to support this program over the last 5 years, feel exactly the same way we do. And I mean, why wouldn't you? Over a five-year period, this program has absolutely exploded. I mean, to a point where you know, this year more than 7,500 books were distributed, you know, to schools and community organizations across our city, across our region. 130 programs throughout our region where people got together and talked about this great book and what was behind this great book and what this book means to us in 2007. Very, very relevant. Again, Independence Blue Cross is thrilled to be involved. We salute the mayor's office. We salute the city administration. We salute everybody at the Free Library, all of the wonderful staff from Elliot Shelkrot to all of his key people who make this program work now as flawlessly as it does. We salute those who get paid to make sure this is a success, but we really want to salute those who have the passion and who year in and year out make sure that those of us who have been involved stay involved. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce a woman who has adopted One Book, One Philadelphia, made it her own, and just year after year it gets more and more successful. So without any further hesitation, I mean, who would have thought that in March of 2007, on a night we celebrate this wonderful book, Waiting for Snow in Havana, that we'd all be waiting for snow in Philadelphia. But, you know, that's the power of Marie Field. I mean, she thinks of every last detail. So, ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce to all of you the person who really makes this work, someone who's done so much, not only with the Free Library, but throughout our city, where so many good causes, Marie Field.
Good evening, and my husband said I had to tell you a story before I get started, because Chris gave me the perfect segue. And talking about my power, I used to be an elementary school teacher, and if the sky was getting a little bit gray and I thought there was a good chance of snow, I would do a little snow dance for the children in the class to help bring on a major snowstorm and give us all a snow holiday. And it worked a lot of times, and I built up a reputation. So as new classes would come in, they would say, "Is it true that so-and-so?" And I said, "Absolutely." So anyhow. Now you know. Well, welcome once more to this closing event. Tonight we celebrate the conclusion of our fifth year of building literacy and community around a single book. I want to pay special tribute and express deepest gratitude to Independent Blue Cross, our lead sponsor since the inception of the project. Your steadfast and generous sponsorship, Chris, of one book has made it possible to transform the dream of our founders, the Free Library of Philadelphia and the office of Mayor John F. Street, into a beloved Philadelphia tradition, enjoyed annually by tens of thousands of individuals throughout the region. In just a few minutes, you will hear from our author, Carlos Ayer, who has captivated Philadelphia since last October, when Waiting for Snow in Havana, Confessions of a Cuban Boy, was announced as this year's one book literary selection. Carlos's voice and the power and poignancy of his memoir have impacted our region, touching our hearts and our lives. With his lyrical evocation of his boyhood in Havana, his depictions of the brutality and repressiveness of the revolution that tore him away from his family and cultural roots, his recollections about his life as an exile in America, Carlos has not only shared his unique immigrant story, but caused us to reflect upon our own journeys to America and our journeys to Philadelphia, a city that embraces and is enriched by its numerous immigrant citizens and communities. Because the 2007 One Book, One Philadelphia project has augmented our personal reading experiences with countless programs and discussions contributed by the library and our fabulous community partners, people from all walks of life have been convening throughout the region over the past few months, attending musical and theatrical performances, films, panel discussions, church sermons, dance, craft, and cooking classes, book group meetings, all inspired by Waiting for Snow in Havana. We have compared ideas about Carlos's book, learned more about Philadelphia's multicultural population, considered the complex issues surrounding immigration, and shared stories. A stranger told me he left Cuba at the same time as Carlos and has never forgotten a little boy within the infamous glass bubble at the Havana airport, who cut himself while separated from his parents awaiting the flight to America. He was sent here bleeding. A friend remembered the excitement of a boyhood classmate, one of the Pedro Pan children, when he saw snow for the first time falling on the schoolyard during recess. I heard about an elderly Cuban doctor who never again practiced medicine following his emigration to America. He was so thrilled that his daughter's book group was reading Waiting for Snow that he cooked a Cuban-style tortilla for them to enjoy during their discussion meeting. I shall always remember when this library's security guard came over to Carlos, shook his hand, and proudly announced his last name, Garcia. I didn't understand the Spanish conversation that followed, but I felt the warmth. I was moved to learn of a children's program developed by a quintet of Philadelphia orchestra musicians who shared their own varied ancestry and immigration stories with the children, along with the music they played. Exemplifying the truth underlying the One Book program, our common humanity revealed by a shared reading experience, was the comment made by a young Taiwanese pianist during a book discussion at the Curtis Institute. She said, "Carlos Eyre's story is mine. The details differ, but the universal human experience of separation and loss are the same." For me, this is a night of mixed emotions. Jubilation for the enormous success of this year's program, boundless gratitude to the library staff, the volunteers, the partners and supporters whose dedication, talent, hard work and generosity have made it all possible. Pleasure in realizing that thousands of people have been reading Waiting for Snow, have been touched and informed by it, and will continue to read it and pass it on. Heartfelt appreciation for Carlos Eyre for his unstinting and inspiring participation in this year's One Book Project. He has been the ubiquitous author, visiting branch libraries, broadcasting interviews, attending breakfasts, luncheons, and dinners, and all the while speaking from the heart to each and every one of us. Carlos has won our affections along with our admiration. Sadness that he will be leaving us, at least for a while. Hope that he will soon return to all of his friends in Philadelphia. If I may paraphrase from the opening of Waiting for Snow, the world changed while I slept. The world changed in Philadelphia while Carlos Eyre was with us for the better. Born in Havana in 1950, Carlos Eyre left his homeland in 1962, one of 14,000 unaccompanied children airlifted out of Fidel Castro's Cuba by Operation Pedro Pan. He was 11 years old and carried with him only a small bag of the barest essentials, together with the vivid memories which are at the heart of his memoir. After living in a series of foster homes in Florida and Illinois, he was reunited with his mother in Chicago in 1965. His father never left Cuba. During his high school years, Carlos worked nights as a dishwasher at a hotel in Chicago, earning the money to help support his mother, brother, and himself. After earning his Ph.D. at Yale University in 1979, Carlos Ayer taught at St. John's University in Minnesota and at the University of Virginia. He is now professor of history and religion at Yale University and lives in Connecticut with his wife and their three children. Winner of the 2003 National Book Award, Waiting for Snow in Havana, has garnered much critical acclaim, including the most accomplished literary expression of exile sensibility to have appeared to date, and a passionate, wildly ambitious memoir that aims to document the social life and customs of his childhood, while also, by the way, delivering a work of art, a tale of a child's life in the distinguished tradition of Huckleberry Finn and To Kill a Mockingbird. And now, it is my honor and privilege to introduce Philadelphia's 2007 One Book author, Mr. Carlos Ayer.
Thank you, Marie. Thank you very much for that lovely introduction. Thank you, all of you, for being here on such a beastly night, weather-wise. I'm glad we're all waiting for snow. Before I get going, I'd also like to thank Jerry Truskin. I've called her my handler this week. She's more than a handler. She's been a guardian angel, and a very efficient guardian angel, because angels can screw up royally. As we know, there's another world filled with angels that didn't do too well, supposedly. We have at the Peabody Museum at Yale a very unique object. It's a meteorite that crashed through someone's roof in Wallingford, Connecticut, and landed at a man's feet as he was watching television. Imagine the odds of that. How special. Well, One Book, One Philadelphia is my golden meteorite. What a special thing. It fell from the sky. You have to understand that while I wrote this book, I was guided by images in my own memory. The book is written around images, and I had to let go. I had to kill the professor, basically. There's one image I had I could not shake, however, as I wrote this book, and that was the image of myself free-falling without a parachute, and even worse, the image I could not shake, hitting the ground and being reduced to nothing, making a total fool out of myself by writing a book such as this. When I go to high schools, I usually entitle my lecture, "When Doing the Wrong Thing is the Right Thing," because I was not supposed to write this book. If I'd followed every guideline by which I'm supposed to organize my life and my ethics, I should not have written this book. But I did. I'm a scholar. I'm a historian. I cover the period 1400 to 1700. I cover religious history. I'm not supposed to write a book like this. One of my dearest friends at the University of Virginia was up for tenure the year after I was tenured. So it was my first tenure case that I got to see from the inside. It's like being admitted to a secret society. But it was a frightful experience because among the 1,001 stupid things I heard my colleagues say about this man, who is now the editor of the most esteemed journal in our field, was that he did not deserve tenure because he had published poetry. He was not serious. He's not a serious historian. Look, he's published poetry, and I'm not talking about sort of self-published poetry. He had published poetry in respectable journals. But the small-mindedness of these former colleagues of mine, to me, was appalling. So I had that in mind as I wrote this book. What will happen? Well, as you know, if you've attended other of my lectures or if you've read interviews I've given or heard interviews I've given on the radio, you know I wrote this book with no intention of publishing it as a memoir, none whatsoever. I wrote a novel. It reads like a novel because I wrote a novel. I just lacked the imagination to invent stuff and wrote straight from memory. I wrote the first chapter April 28th, 2000. I invented a few things for that first draft of that first chapter. The next night, I sat down to write the second chapter. I said, the hell with inventing things. It's too hard. It's too hard. How am I going to invent threads and then tie them together? So I wrote straight from memory and kept going and kept going. My dear wife, Jane, I showed her the first chapter, said, "Don't look back. Don't rewrite anything. Do not rewrite. Do not do what you do. Do not give in to your obsessive, compulsive, scholarly self." By the way, once when my brother was seeing a therapist, he was asked, "What does your brother do?" And he said, "Well, he's a professor at Yale." He said, "Oh, then certainly obsessive, compulsive disorder must run in your family." And she said, "Don't look back. Don't rewrite anything." I trusted her. And it's the best thing I ever did. As I sat upstairs at the dinner, which I wish all of you could have attended because we had lovely Cuban music and wonderful food. This is better than a dream for me. A good dream is a hard thing to come by. A good dream in real life, it's a real gift. It's better than that meteorite. When I received a phone call from Marie Field some months ago, talked to Marie and to her husband, Joe, I knew I was talking to very special people. I was overjoyed, of course, at being chosen for One Book, One Philadelphia. What a thrill. What a wonderful thrill. But meeting them over the phone has been like meeting all of you that I've met here over the past few weeks. Going back to October, the times I've been here and spoken with you, I've made so many good friends, so many special, wonderful people. The story I tell in Waiting for Snow in Havana, which was intended to be read as a novel, was written out of anger, anguish, desperation. I could go on and on with words that refer to emotions that are not pleasant, not in the least. Desperation is the one I'd like to focus on. I was desperate. As a Cuban, as a middle-aged man about to turn 50, who knew he was not going to be able to buy a motorcycle, I had been born in Cuba, but I came to the U.S. in 1962, and since about mid-1963, I hid the fact that I was Cuban. Little by little, so much so that by the time I got to 1969, I hid it altogether, not because I was ashamed of being Cuban. And if someone found out, I wouldn't deny it. But it was too painful to be a Cuban in the United States. Not because this country had not welcomed me with open arms and provided all sorts of wonderful opportunities, but because, sadly, the ignorance I encountered when people found out I was Cuban was so profound that I could not deal with it. I buried things very deeply I thought I buried them successfully. Then occasionally something very odd would happen. I would hear a word in Spanish or read a word in Spanish, and suddenly this whole world would open up. The world that is now described in Waiting for Snow in Havana. I could just hear one word, and it would do it. Or I'd smell something, and it would pop open. I'd see someone who looked familiar, someone I remembered from childhood, and boom, poof, that door would open. What we have inside our heads is truly marvelous, our memory. Even when we bury things, you know, it's very hard to bury them successfully. I had to come to terms with the fact of my own mortality approaching 50, and my own identity as a Cuban, especially because in 1999, something happened. A little boy showed up off the coast of Florida. You all know him, Elian Gonzalez. I'm sure you were sick of hearing about him. He represented for me in a way I could not explain even to myself all of my past and the past of my people, Cuban people, represented all of our suffering. And then, even worse, in the news media, all the ignorance I'd had to put up with, all the questions such as, what was it like to wear shoes for the first time when you came to the United States? Or the finger-wagging lecture on how wonderful the Cuban Revolution had been for the Cuban people, especially after I got into my business, into academia, where it's a widely held myth that Fidel Castro has done wonderful things for the Cuban people. I wrote the book as an educator. It's not a job for me, it's a calling. Whenever I encounter ignorance, I try to correct it. Whether it's the student who defines the bubonic plague in an exam as a plague that caused people to grow boobs on their neck. Or someone asking me what it was like to wear shoes for the first time. Or a woman I once dated in Minnesota who had a PhD and had gone to very fine educational institutions who once asked me, very puzzled, as we were on our way. We used to drive an hour and a half each way to Minneapolis-St. Paul just to go to a movie, because where we lived there was no movie theater. And there were no DVDs back then, and very few VCRs. She asked me once, where did your father go to school in the United States? And I said, my father never left Havana. He never even went to another part of Cuba. And she was very puzzled. And they said, but wasn't your father a lawyer and a judge? And I said, yes. And then she looked even more puzzled and wrinkled up her face and asked, well, where then was he trained? Came as a great surprise to her that Havana had universities and law schools. And even a greater surprise when I told her, I'm sorry to tell you this, but the University of Havana is far older than any institution you have attended in the United States. You know, including the University of North Carolina, founded in the late 18th century, and my former employer, the University of Virginia, founded in the early 19th century. I wrote the book as a witness. And in the past week, I have been dwelling on this. I hope I'm not dwelling on it too much. Eli Wiesel is far more eloquent on this than I could ever be. But when you bear witness to an injustice, you're using one of the most powerful weapons that we human beings have in the face of evil. And that's our memory. Our memory contains a very vivid record of the past. And all we are is the past. I've said this many, many times this week. The present is an illusory, ever-moving moment. Say the word now, as St. Augustine pointed out, 1,600 years ago. Say the word now, by the time you get to the last letter, it's no longer now. It's already in the past. All we are is the past. Eli Wiesel and my colleague at Yale, Miroslav Volf, have pointed out in many ways that evil can triumph multiple times, way beyond the evil act, way beyond the injustice. There are other evils, evil shadow reflections. One of them would be vengeance. When an evil is answered with another evil. All our moms and dads taught us this, you know, two wrongs don't make a right. Well, but another way in which evil can triumph is when the memory of an injustice is wiped out or denied. What I've tried to do is to bear witness to the injustices of the Cuban Revolution. And I've been challenged by some audience members while visiting Philadelphia. I always get challenged. Today, a beautiful thing happened at a branch library. A man stood up and spoke for, I think it was about 10 minutes, a very long-winded tirade against me personally and what I represented. And then he turned to address the high school students in the back of the room, tried to put them all in the same box and say, you know, You kids should not listen to this man. No one interrupted him. No one ushered him out of the room. I shook his hand, and I said, God bless you. You've proved my point. This is a wonderful country. You say whatever you want. If he had said such a thing, well, for one thing, there wouldn't be a library in Cuba that let you borrow any book you wanted. You proved my point, sir. Thank you. God bless you. You can say whatever you want. If he had said that in Cuba, he'd be in prison now. On the very same day that this country made the fateful error of invading Iraq, Fidel Castro took advantage of the opportunity by rounding up all sorts of dissidents, most of whom were either journalists or librarians. Independent librarians who allowed people to borrow books that were not acceptable, including among them the writings of Martin Luther King Jr. And they burned many of these books, believe it or not, in the year 2003, 90 miles from Key West, books were burned. Including the works of Martin Luther King Jr., including a copy of Martin Luther King Jr.'s works, which had been donated to one of these free libraries by our former president, Jimmy Carter, and was autographed by President Jimmy Carter. That's what I tried to bear witness to. I've been asked this week many times, you know, we thought your book was supposed to be about immigration, but you hardly talk about your experiences in the U.S. Well, the book is not exactly speaking on immigration, but what precedes immigration, the history of so many different nationalities, peoples who have come to this country fleeing all sorts of horrors, looking for a better life, and looking for what I know my children think is a pure abstraction, and many adults I encounter think is a pure abstraction, and perhaps not even something that's real. Freedom, autonomy. Freedom can become a very dirty word in the mouths of some, can become a smokescreen for all sorts of things, but freedom is a very, very real thing, the freedom to say and think whatever you want. And not have anyone tell you how to think, what to do, when to do it. My uncle, who still lives in Havana, was sitting at his desk one day. He was a petrochemical engineer in Cuba. And someone he didn't recognize at all came up to his desk and asked him point blank, "Do you believe in God?" And he laughed. He tells me. So he told me the story. He said, "I laughed at this man, and I said, yes, of course I do." Well, he was fired from his job. His job was considered far too sensitive for anyone who believed in anything other than the sacred revolution. I could regale you with more and more stories of the way in which rights are violated constantly in Cuba. I am so happy, so thrilled this book, instead of turning out to be a fatal jump and free fall, followed by a tremendous splat like some awful self-destructing meteorite, I have managed to change some people's minds, to open their minds, to fill in gaps. I, for a long time, not only hid the fact I was Cuban, but also tried to get as far away from Cuba as possible. And I chose, therefore, to study late medieval and early modern period. If I'd had more money and more time, I would have studied antiquity. And if I'd had even more time and money, I might have actually done Chinese history, just so I could get so far away. It's created kind of some funny situations, absolutely funny. I'll never forget my first week at the University of Virginia. I was asked by one of my colleagues, how in the world did you ever choose such a Nordic subject as the German Reformation? I was speechless because this man was a WASP from Maine who specialized in African religions. We Hispanics are not supposed to do that kind of stuff, you know. We Hispanics, whenever I go to a conference, you know, and we're wearing name tags and so on, I swear, 9 times out of 10, people look at my name. They're a little puzzled by the Spanish and Irish combination. But it's the first name that gives me away. And 9 times out of 10, someone will say, you're in the Spanish department, aren't you? And when I say no, I'm in the history department. 8 times out of 10 in response, you must do Latin American history. It's all we can do. And it's all we're capable of doing in many people's minds. Well, this country has welcomed me and all my people with open arms, as it has welcomed so many other people. Whatever prejudice I have encountered, all of it fueled by ignorance, has always been overwhelmingly covered over by the love and openness of others. And this is one of the other wonderful things about this country. It's not just freedom, but it's the very idea, the very conceit that all of us take for granted, that we're all equal. What a great conceit that we're all equal, and that prejudice is a very bad thing. And most of us are taught in our own homes. I remember one incident in 7th grade. We were playing softball, Bloomington Junior High School in Bloomington, Illinois, home, birthplace of Adlai Stevenson. And I struck out. And here's another burden to carry. Everyone has always expected me to be good at baseball. Everyone has always expected me to be a good dancer. And I am neither. I always strike out. Always. So I struck out. And one boy, Max Thoman, T-H-O-M-A-N, whose father was a policeman in Bloomington, spit in my face and called me a blank and spick. Fill in the blank. All the other kids ganged up on him. They restrained him. They started yelling at him. They accused him of being an idiot and told me, one of them, I can't remember who said this, but one of the boys said to me, don't listen to Max. He's an idiot. And so is his father. That's what's wonderful about America. I waited for snow in Havana. If you've read the book. I get asked about the title all the time. That was not the original title, as many of you know. I'll continue to say this. I love the title. I came up with it. But the original title was considered unacceptable. Kiss the Lizard, Jesus. Kiss the Lizard, Jesus. It was considered inappropriate. So I suggested, how about Kiss the Lizard, Cuban Boy? No, that was inappropriate too. And of course I thought at the time, I didn't know anything about the publishing business. I thought they were trying to get me on Oprah. You know, I thought they were trying to have a title that would appeal to Oprah. So I suggested there's a third option for a title. Kiss My Ass, Oprah. And I'm hoping that will get me to her. But I got angry. When I get angry, I get creative. Waiting for Snow is fueled by anger, desperation. I got angry, and I suggested 250 titles. And I emailed this list to my agent and my editor simultaneously, and they both replied nearly simultaneously. And out of the list of 250, both of them said, it's got to be Waiting for Snow in Havana. Now, don't get me wrong, 250, there were variations on themes. A very close variation, which was not chosen, was Pining for Fjords in Havana. Because I desperately wanted to be a Viking. I desperately wanted to be Nordic. I wanted to live up north where there was snow. Because when at the age of 8, I looked at a map of the world, I remember on my nice cold marble floor, you know, on a hot day in Havana, those marble floors are wonderful. They don't heat up at all. They're like as close as you can get to snow, other than the freezer, in which I always used to stick my head back when freezers had frost, right? And I'd scrape out the frost and feel it and try to imagine it was snow. And, of course, I'd get yelled at for leaving the refrigerator open. But I wanted snow because looking at that map, I realized that the countries that didn't have snow didn't amount to much when it came to autonomy and industry. Countries that didn't have snow didn't have empires. Countries that didn't have snow got bossed around by other countries, including my ancestral homeland, Spain. I have plenty of snow in Spain. I thought, gee, our problems will be solved here in Cuba if the climate turns cold. I also put this together with Christmas. You have to understand, before Fidel, I think Cubans still do this. Cubans send me more Christmas cards than any other segment of the population. Cubans love Christmas cards, but we used to send each other Christmas cards with snow scenes. And I associated snow with Christmas, with Santa Claus, and wouldn't the nicest man in the world, Santa Claus, pick the nicest place, the North Pole? I got my wish. I ended up spending 2 years in Minnesota. And I still remember that first heating bill in Minnesota, which was twice my monthly income. I ran out and found myself a housemate from North Dakota, an even colder place, who understood these things. But I got my wish double time. Lots of snow, lots of cold. We all wait for things that we think are going to make our world better. We wait passively sometimes for changes. We wait very passively. I still remember, speaking of odd juxtapositions and an immigrant experience, sitting in my classroom in Bloomington, Illinois, I had never seen snow. Okay, I was waiting for that great day when I would first see snow. I couldn't wait. I was beside myself. I had moved somewhere up north where they had Christmas trees growing out of the ground, for heaven's sakes. And I was waiting for my snow. So it starts to snow late November. And I'm transfixed. I'm looking out the window. And the teacher says, because I became Charles in Bloomington, and very quickly Charlie and then Chuck. Charles, what's the matter? Haven't you ever seen snow before? And I said, no. And the teacher thought I was being a wise ass. And I can't remember what kind of reprimand I got for, you know, seeing snow for the first time. Put together the snow and the lizard. I thought snow was the best thing that could ever happen. I thought snow was what I now think and know divine grace is. Great gift from above that enables us to be better than we could be without. I used to think lizards were horrible. I still think reptiles are horrible. I hate them. I still hate them. I won't go near them. I don't kill them anymore. I don't kill them. We had a snake in our basement this summer. Tiny little snake. And for me, that was the apocalypse. A snake in the house. My kids are still making fun of me for it. My daughter grabbed it. I'm no macho man. I'm no Cuban macho. I'm no baseball player, dancer, or macho man. But I thought lizards were horrible. I thought all reptiles were horrible. I thought snow was wonderful. Well, we project a lot onto the world. We project our likes and dislikes onto the world. One theme in my book, which is throughout from start to finish, is that we need to embrace and love and even kiss that which we hate and we find horrible and disgusting, because that's the best way to get through life. Sometimes the most awful things are our redemption. Exile can be redemption. Losing your identity, beginning anew in another place, can be redemption. Embracing all the pain that comes with it and the growth that comes with it can be redemption. I think you multiply this tens of millions, hundreds of millions of times in American history. We're all hyphenated. We are all hyphenated. Even the people to whom this land belonged, who are now called Native Americans. There's no hyphen in Native American, but, you know, it's you can't just be American. You have to be qualified as Native American. But we're all hyphenated in some way. Multiply times tens, hundreds of millions of times the accommodation process, and what you have is one great nation in which our equality to a great degree rests precisely on our diversity. That is the ultimate saving grace in this great land, our diversity, and the great respect that most of us have for one another. If there's any way in which I can say that Waiting for Snow in Havana is an immigrant story, even though it deals with what happens before I got here, is that it details what is left behind and the fact that most of the people who have come to this great land have left a lot behind. But most have been immensely glad to leave it behind and find something wonderful and new. People ask me if I'm going to write a sequel. Right now I'm saying no. The rest is really boring. The rest is really boring, and it's not exotic. I didn't plan to write this book. It just happened. I consider it a gift from above, just as this program, One Book, One Philadelphia. Over the past week, over the past month, over the past 3-4 years, I have been able to become a different kind of teacher and a different person. I was never called an author, although I had written 3 books, until I wrote a book without footnotes. I finally figured out the meaning to these words. A writer is someone who writes fiction. An author is someone who writes books without footnotes. I am now an author and a professional Cuban and a scholar. I'll try to balance the two. I'll leave you with this anecdote. We all have to find our identities in this world, whether it's our ethnic identity, our cultural identity, our religious identity, whatever, but we also have to find our identity in our relations with other people. What do? How do we spend our lives? The wonderful thing about identity in this country, added to the layer cake of wonderful things, is that really you can be whatever you want. If you set your mind to it, very few barriers. There are certain things you can't do. You know, I could never play professional baseball, no matter how much I wished it. But you can be whatever you want. Now I am two people. And no better proof of this than the fact that at a scholarly conference in Paris, after I'd given my paper, we all went out for dinner. And as happens during scholarly conferences, conversation is all about work. Work, 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 work. Someone let out, had the bad manners to reveal to the rest of the table that I had won the National Book Award in the United States. And they all looked puzzled, and conversation stopped. It stopped dead. The conversation killer. And they asked me, for what? Because they didn't know. They didn't know. For what? And then I explained what this book was, Waiting for Snow in Havana. And a colleague seated directly across from me, an American, screwed up his face and let out a little harumph. Screwed up his face and said, well, you know what this means, don't you? I said, no, what does it mean? He says, it means you're going to be remembered for that book, not for your work as a historian. And I said, I can live with that. Then the French historian who was hosting us, a historian I very much admire, whose work I still recommend and actually force my graduate students to put on their PhD orals reading list. You have to read Robert Mouchemblé. Without skipping a beat, put it all in perspective for me as only a French historian can, with immaculate precision and no small amount of cruelty. He said, well, you certainly won't win a prize for the paper you gave us today. That's where we are. Now I'd like to open it up for questions.
Well, that was wonderful. I'm Elliot Shalkrut, the president of the library, and I have this horrible task of choosing who gets to answer questions. We have volunteers here. Who gets to ask them? Excuse me. He gets to answer them.
You can answer the questions.
No. But at any rate, I'm delighted to help in the discussion. We have two volunteers on either side. We'd like you to raise your hand so that it makes sure everybody hears, and we do try to keep a record of these discussions. So please raise your hand, and we'll get a microphone to you as soon as we can. We'll go right here, and then to the gentleman in the green shirt there, and then we'll come into the middle.
Good evening. This is the first time I've ever asked a question at one of these events, but I want to say that I share your terror of lizards. That was the best part of the book for me, was like, whoa, somebody else knows about this. Every poster advertising One Book Philadelphia for the whole year has a big old lizard on it. That's all.
I have a lizard on my tie clip. Yeah.
Okay, gentleman right here.
I had the pleasure to go to Cuba in 2003, and I was wondering, and I, you know, found this to be an incredible culture and country. What about the freedom of Americans to travel to Cuba? what's your position on that in terms of getting rid of the embargo so that Americans can experience
right.
like Europeans and the British do?
Here's my take on it. Okay, humanitarian trips are wonderful. I'm sorry, somebody said they hate the humanitarian trips. Okay, well, here's what most people don't know about travel to Cuba. Like South Africa in the bad old days, Cuba now has an apartheid system. Foreigners who come to Cuba get to stay in wonderful hotels, eat wonderful food, swim at marvelous beaches, buy all kinds of things, which ordinary Cubans are barred from. If I were to visit Cuba, my Uncle Mario could not set foot through the door of my hotel to visit me in my hotel. And the tourists who go there, blithely ignorant of this horrible reality. Forbes magazine every year runs a list of the 10 sexiest islands in the world. And 2 years ago, Cuba was on their top 10 list as a sexy island. And guess what they said? Imagine being at a cocktail party and impressing all the other guests with the fact that you've been to a forbidden place. I think if they do away with the apartheid, it would be a great thing. As to the embargo, I'm no economist. I nearly failed math in high school. But I do know this. The embargo right now is a psychological smokescreen. Most Americans do not know this. Okay, but the United States is the largest foreign source of food for Cuba. The United States right now is Cuba's fourth largest trading partner. We sell all kinds of agricultural products to Cuba. The collapse of the Cuban economy has not been due to the embargo, as Fidel likes to claim, but rather to the fact that their economy is heavy-handedly centralized, and they come up with all sorts of stupid plans that don't work, and there's no free enterprise. I would love for the ferry between Miami and Havana to resume operation. I would love for the entire world, not just Americans, to flock to Havana, but I would like, once foreigners get there, for Cubans to be able to enjoy the same rights as privileges as the people who visit them. I think it's only fair. And that's my take.
Thank you. We have several people in the middle. The gentleman with the blue shirt. Let's get the microphone there.
I'm not going to give a whole history. My question is, you refer to your mother and your father as Marie Antoinette
right.
and King
yes.
Louis the 16th. Was that a fact, verdad, or is it something in you used as in your imagination?
No. Every review but the review in The New Yorker accused me of getting carried away with my magical realism, especially in regard to my father and mother. All of you Philadelphians will be very glad to hear that my father's belief in reincarnation, which was very, very real, came straight from Philadelphia. Okay, the American Theosophical Society, right here in Philadelphia, founded by Madame Blavatsky, whose home is now the White Dog Cafe. Okay. They sent missionaries all over the world, but their most successful mission was Cuba. And my father's family there, the entire family, believed in reincarnation. My father, I think, would have been a marvelous writer instead of a judge. And he always told me, do something with your life that you like to do, not like me, he kept saying. I don't like being a judge. He claimed he could remember all sorts of details about his past lives. I don't exaggerate at all in this book. I just thought it was such a wonderful, ironic, and paradoxical juxtaposition that you have a man who remembered when his head was sliced off by the guillotine and constantly told us what it felt like to see the basket come up towards your face. would live through another revolution, right? And not do much in response. So it was perfect. It was as divinely constructed that I should grow up in a household with a man who thought he was Louis XVI, who also had strange and bizarre coincidences in his own life. Imagine, I spell it out in the book, a Jewish refugee from the Nazi Holocaust who was able to take some possessions, came to Cuba with some paintings and sold them one by one. My father buys one very cheaply, and it's none other than a portrait of Empress Maria Theresa of Austria, the mother of Marie Antoinette. And it hung in our living room, and it scared the hell out of me.
Okay, please, the woman who was, yeah, no, yeah, you right here. Next to the gentleman in the blue, you had your hand up before the people behind you.
Thank you. Should I say it in Spanish or in English? I have to say it in both languages. Ha sido admirable. Todo lo que ha dicho es una poesía.
Gracias.
It's a sad feeling to hear somebody say, I had a pleasure to go to Cuba. It hurts me so much that I cannot listen to it or admire it or even feel for it. Now, your book is wonderful. I imagine it and look at it as a satire. It's a recollection of the same things that I felt true when I left Cuba. And the fact that there are people and lovely human beings that want to go to Cuba, it just makes me feel so sad because I believe that they don't understand our pain. They don't understand our crying. We function, we do as much as we can. I am a physician, a pediatrician. I love to work in this country and sometimes even think that Fidel did a big favor to us because we were able to live in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a wonderful country, and which gave us the opportunity of our lifetime. But to have people go and visit Cuba, like you said, it's a distorted image of what Cuba was. Well, and it's giving Castro the feeling that we're interested in visiting him. It hurts me. It hurts me so much.
I understand exactly everything you're saying. I forget the man's name, but he's the travel writer for the Florida Sun Sentinel. Anybody know? He sent me a piece he wrote because he went on a special tour for travel writers to Cuba about 3 years ago. His piece was wonderful, but boy, it made me cry for hours because of the things he heard the other travel people say. Things such as, oh, I hope they never get a Starbucks here. Oh, wouldn't it be terrible if these buildings got fixed up? Wouldn't it be terrible? Wouldn't it be terrible? Wouldn't it be terrible? They kept saying about everything they saw, the utter ruin and destruction of Cuba. And then the very naive and very condescending, perhaps even bigoted, attitude of those who said, aren't these people happy? Look how happy they are. In a way, if any of you know about this, you know, many, many try to think of third world people as kind of Rousseau's noble savage. You know, they're simpler, they're purer than us. They don't need the things we have. Their lives are better because they don't have Walmart. Their lives are better because they don't have choices to make for dinner. They only have one thing to eat for dinner. And this travel piece, I wish I could remember the man's name. You know, it was a heart-rending and immensely perceptive description of what goes on. And it's not just Cuba, though. You know, it's the entire third world. There's my brother. He always calls me at 9. What time is it?
9.
Yeah, okay. Tony, I'll put him on. He's doing much better. Much better. If you want to hear a very interesting story. If you've read the book, you know my brother. You know, he was in bad shape. He was a diabetic who didn't take good care of himself and eventually ended up blacking out, crashing his car several times. So he ended up in a nursing home. There was no other. It was a hard choice to make, but he had to end up in a nursing home, so get him back on track, and he's back on track. But at the nursing home, you know, I've revealed everything about myself in this book that I didn't want to reveal, so now I don't feel the least bit ashamed to reveal these secrets. His wife left him. His wife dumped him and left him in the nursing home and never visited him or called him or anything. The activities director at the nursing home heard that there was a patient with a brother who had written a book. That's very unusual in a nursing home. Her interest was piqued. And she picked up my book and read it, liked it so much, she began to read it as an activity for the patients every Thursday. And this is how my brother heard the book, because he couldn't bring himself to read it. In his own boastful way, he kept saying, "I don't need to read it. I lived it." He's a tough guy. He claims he worked for the CIA. I'm starting to believe him.
Okay. Let's have some more questions.
Well,
oh, I'm sorry.
Over.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The best part is yet to come.
My apologies.
The activities director fell in love with my brother. Saw through the shell. Saw the boy. And now they're living together.
That's fine. Okay, let's have some more questions. The gentleman right in the middle there, then we'll go to the woman in the red behind him, and then we'll go over to you, sir. I'm trying to jump around and give as many people as possible an opportunity.
I grew up in Miami, and the part of your memoir. Here I am.
Oh, you're back. Okay, I'm trying to see.
The part of your memoir that I found particularly interesting was your description of the time when you first arrived in South Florida. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious if you keep up with any of the contacts that you made down there.
I stay in touch with my foster parents, Norma and Louis Chait, and with my brother's foster parents. Sidney Rubin passed away a couple years ago, but his wife, Carol. Wonderful people. I stay in touch with them. Lou's not doing too well. He's severe diabetes. But they're wonderful people. Every time I go to their house, it is home, even though I only spent 9 months with them. But all the other people, no. I don't have many Miami connections. I have two cousins in Miami, the ones I lived with in Bloomington. They did what just about every Cuban who moved up north would eventually do, which is to move back south to Miami. I would say that over half of the Cubans in my public high school in Chicago moved back to Miami and are now there. We had a nice reunion back in 2003. Yeah. Sen High School Cubans traded stories. Wonderful things. Talk about an immigrant experience. Coming home with a report card explaining to your parents that in this country, F is the highest grade. But I have to say this, now that you mention South Florida, because we're here at a library, and I've visited a lot of branch libraries, I wouldn't be standing here if it weren't for a tiny, dinky little branch library in Miami. Now, those of you that know Miami, the east-west streets are what, streets or avenues? Anyone know? East-west. Anyway, 7th. 7th Street, northwest. When I was living in a home for juvenile delinquents, me and my brother, when we were reunited in the home for juvenile delinquents, my brother found this library. And we went there every night just to get away from the home. It was our refuge. And before you know it, you know, I had checked out and read the entire history section because it was a dinky little branch. But that was my first serious step towards becoming a historian. And my salvation was a little dinky branch library that I think had, at the time we went there at night, there was only one person. There was only one librarian taking care of things.
Great. Okay. I had said the woman who's in the red. Yeah.
At the beginning of your talk, you mentioned desperation. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if writing the book or its widespread success has eased some of your desperation.
Yes and no, because what I now do as a professional Cuban and author is constantly encounter people who display the same ignorance I'm trying to dispel, and without actually, no one has actually used the word lie or liar, accuse me of lying. And when I say things such as, you know, people do get tortured in Cuba, people jump up and say, no, that's not true. Or as a professor at my own alma mater, of all places, Loyola University of Chicago, I was at dinner there, I was giving two lectures. One as a professional Cuban, an author, the other as a scholar. One lecture on levitation, the subject I'm working on, the other lecture on waiting for snow in Havana. We're having a dinner. Somehow it came up, you know, human rights. I tend to bring up the subject. And I mentioned to the professor seated next to me who taught in the English department that I thought it was very revealing, very sad, and very ironic that on the very same day that the dictator, the horrible dictator, Augusto Pinochet, was arrested in London to be tried for crimes against humanity, Fidel Castro was visiting Spain and being greeted as a great hero in Cuba because Fidel had killed, and I said, tens of thousands of people more than Augusto Pinochet. The man jumped out of his chair and said, that's a lie. That's not true. That can't be. And so on and so forth. And then some other intellectual at the other end of the table, as the conversation deteriorated, added, well, if I had to choose between a right-wing dictator and a left-wing dictator, I would always choose the left. And I said, I suppose that means you preferred Stalin to Hitler. As I keep pointing out to people, they keep saying, you know, in Cuba they have free education and free universal health care. I point out to people, you know, the Third Reich offered that to Germans. They did. They had a high price to pay, but so have Cubans. And nobody wants to take that into account. So the desperation is still there, as you could probably see. It's visible. It's coming out of me. I wish I could somehow get it through to people that Cubans are 100% human and have the same needs and aspirations as North Americans and Western Europeans.
Okay, we have some more people. Let's go over to the side here.
Is there a relationship between being sensitive to politics as a child and an awareness of culture as an adult?
Oh, I think so, definitely.
Can you describe how people who are sensitive to that can learn how to put it into language?
Could everybody hear the question? Okay. Okay, well, why don't you repeat the question?
Well, let me see if I got the question correctly.
Okay.
It's a two-part question. What's the relationship between being sensitive to politics as a child and to culture together? And then the second part of the question was how they're related. Could I give an example? Is that correct? Okay. Well, growing up with bombs going off at night as I fell asleep and the sound of gunfire off in the distance, as in the Talking Heads song, which I love, gunfire off in the distance. I know, I hear it, you know. Growing up, seeing in the newspaper every single day bloody corpses, hearing of relatives arrested by Batista's police and tortured by Batista's police. I was politicized very early on. I was cheering for Fidel. And actually not for Fidel so much, because Fidel was not the only one fighting against Batista. I was fighting for anyone who was against Batista. At first, Fidel seemed really cool with his beard and so on. But I was highly politicized. And actually, before Batista was ousted. My parents began to worry about what I was saying about Batista because I went to school with his children. And I've always had a very loose tongue. And my mom, God bless her, always called me lengua larga, long tongue, loose lips. I grew up thinking this was just the world. I came to the United States, however, you see, and there was none of that. Here you have civil discourse. And I came to the United States at precisely the same time that the civil rights movement was getting underway. I saw, as a child and teenager, how a culture, right, and a social and economic structure make a difference in politics. And it's a great lesson. I became very attuned to cultural things and to the fact, especially my first foster parents, the Chaits, you know, their parents had fled from Russia. Lou Chait, his father, had watched his brother shot to death at their doorstep by a Cossack. And he reminded me several times that that's the reason they were taking me in. I just wanted to return the favor. I wasn't precocious. I wasn't precocious. I think it's the juxtaposition of growing up in a very different culture with a violent politics and coming to a place such as the United States where you could see thousands upon thousands and thousands of people at the mall in Washington, D.C. I remember being glued to the television in August of 63 in Miami just shortly before I left and see all those thousands of people on the mall in Washington. And when I heard Martin Luther King Jr., I didn't know what to think. You know, I thought I was hearing God, actually. It's a great lesson to learn. I tell my kids they're growing in much less interesting times.
Okay, right straight back here.
Is it working? Yes. Thank you for remembering Batista. You are a historian. You are in the United States. Remember, this started with a revolution, too.
Yes.
Generally, when there is a revolution, there is a reason for it.
Yes, absolutely.
So we go back to Batista.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the comment about visiting Cuba. You mention the Cubans being like apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
Take your word for it. We are not allowed to visit Cuba. This is this is a free country.
Mm-hmm.
We are restricted. We don't know the Cubans are restricted. Wouldn't it be more sense if we were allowed to go and see for ourselves?
No. I'm not. Let me use the most awful English possible, the kind my students sometimes use. I'm not totally unconflicted. okay? I'm not totally unconflicted, sir. The bad thing, one of the worst things about totalitarian regimes is that they make everyone, inside and out, walk on a very perilous knife edge. And tough and awful decisions are made in which no one wins. There are as many reasons. I don't agree 100% with American foreign policy towards Cuba, don't get me wrong. And I'll get back to Batista in a minute. I'm not 100% in favor of the way in which things get done, such as the fact that I can no longer send my poor uncle the $300 per year I was able to send him before. He really needed those, and he still needs them now more than ever because he's 81. Okay, so I'm not as to Americans traveling to Cuba, yes, I would love for the freedom. And actually, you know, if I examine my principles deep down, follow the golden rule, I would have to say, yes, allow everyone to travel to Cuba, but let's see if Cuba would allow that, because there are as many or more reasons for the way things are now from the Cuban side. They wouldn't want the island flooded with Americans. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you're aware of this, but they published a booklet about yay thick last year, regulations of how Cubans are to interact with tourists. There are laws as to how Cubans can interact. They're not supposed to have long, extensive conversations with tourists, and it is now illegal in Cuba, although everyone does it, to accept a tip. As to Batista, the man was a horrible dictator. He was awful. I hated him. 99% of the Cuban population hated him. All sorts of valiant men fought against Batista. Fidel was not the only one. There were a lot of university students. There were other revolutionary groups. What Fidel did in the first few months of 1959 is to squeeze each and every one of these other groups completely out of existence.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.